Sometimes it becomes easy to forget how special America is.
That unique blend of optimism, humility, and the utter confidence that when the world needs someone to do the really big stuff, you need an American.
We do not have a choice. We cannot be reluctant to lead, and you cannot lead from behind.
I hope we have once again reminded people that man is not free unless government is limited. There's a clear cause and effect here that is as neat and predictable as a law of physics. As government expands, liberty contracts.
Wow! What's this?
This is the North Pole.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it isn't.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. Where's the snow?
Why are you smiling like that?
I just like to smile. Smiling's my favorite.
Make work your favorite. That's your favorite, okay?
Okay.
Work is your new favorite.
Fine.
Time for the announcement. Okay, people, tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., Santa's coming to town.
Santa! Oh, my God!
Santa here? I know him. I know him.
So as you'll find out in the next several weeks, and, you know, if you haven't noticed already, Christmas is my favorite holiday, and that is my favorite Christmas movie. I was almost in pain trying not to laugh through that. Merry Christmas. What is it, like 31 days in advance? Late happy Thanksgiving. I actually, let me apologize in advance if I just like keel over and fall asleep at any time in this broadcast, because I drove approximately 4.5 to 5 hours this morning, got back about an hour and a half ago, drove back from Kansas because I was there for Thanksgiving and one of the most important days of the year, Black Friday. So I'm a little bit tired, didn't have much prep time. So you know what? I'm just going to go on several rants today, which, you know, tend to actually be more fun than most. So the first thing I want to get to is what I did last night, actually. Last night I went to see the movie Lincoln, which, I haven't heard any bad reviews of it yet. I mean, the acting is spectacular. I'm assuming it's pretty historically accurate. From what I've seen, it's pretty historically accurate. But the acting is great. I don't know if any of you actually saw Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which I actually kind of liked that movie. But this movie, the actual Lincoln movie, was much much more accurate and a much more, I guess, honorable portrayal of Abraham Lincoln. I think the big thing I noticed, besides, you know, the whole vampire thing, is the fact that in Lincoln, in the most recent movie, Mary Todd Lincoln actually is crazy, which she was, whereas in Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, she was like this complete sweet Southern woman. No, she was crazy. And they showed that during the movie. So it was a great movie. I thought there were a couple things that I pulled from it. I mean, first off, I think, how many days has it been since the election? I lost count. Less than a month, 3 weeks or something like that. I was watching the movie, and, you know, it's obviously, it takes place in early 1865, the last few months of Lincoln's life. It's, you know, talking about the closing of the Civil War. And actually, I mean, it's called Lincoln. It's mainly about Lincoln, but it's a lot of it really has to do with the ratification of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. That's primarily what a lot of the events in the movie surround. I mean, it's really not so much about the Civil War. It's about the methods and the process of ratifying this amendment and banning slavery. So what I noticed in the film is that people were incredibly, incredibly divided. You know, which I mean, I guess is pretty obvious. It was the Civil War. They were literally, you know, divided as in two separate nations. Or, you know, and that was a debate at the time too. Were they two separate nations or were they just, you know, rebels within a nation? Anyway, I saw some similarities but some major differences between then and now. I mean, yeah, you think we're divided now? It's nothing compared to what they were going through in 1865. Nothing. I mean, back towards the founding of our country, the 18th century, 19th century, fistfights would literally break out in the middle of Congress. You know, and we say we're divided. It was a little bit polarizing. I mean, in this movie, they were dealing with the issue of slavery. So obviously it's going to be contentious. It's almost as if, you know, the Republicans and Democrats started debating abortion on the floor of Congress. I mean, it's one of those extremely contentious issues, much more contentious than probably anything we have today. So they were very polarized. So I think something we need to think about now is that, you know, there are so many people saying, you know, we're too polarized. We'll never, you know, get over this polarization or anything like that. But historically speaking, we're closer together than we have been in several different occasions in the past. You know, so keep that in mind. I mean, go see that movie and try to tell me that you think we're really polarized now. We are. There's no doubt, but. You know, it's certainly been worse, and we're not even close, not even remotely close to Civil War status or secession status, for that matter. Hint, hint. We're not seceding from the Union. The other thing I noticed that I actually thought was more interesting was the movie was primarily about the divisions within the Republican Party, and not so much within the Democratic Party. There were Democrats who came over and voted. For the 13th Amendment, voted to ban slavery, and there were Republicans that wanted to go the other way. I mean, but it was very clear that there was the more conservative faction of the Republican Party, and there was the more, I don't want to say moderate, but, you know, establishment not, the, faction. I mean, let me give an example. The Congressman Stevens, who is played by Tommy Lee Jones, who... one of my favorite actors. If you haven't seen The Fugitive, great, great movie. He was in the, I mean, I guess what you call the conservative faction. He was, you know, a very staunch abolitionist. I don't want to give too much of the movie away. So if you haven't seen the movie, there's a chance I might completely spoil it for you. So you might want to turn off for a couple minutes. But he was a strong abolitionist. He believed not just in the equality of people under the law, but the equality of all humans, regardless of race, regardless of gender, regardless of whatever, at least according to the movie. And so he represented the more abolitionist, conservative side of the party. And then there were, you know, other members who were, you know, mainly wanted to end the war. That was their, you know, main goal. You know, I mean, obviously ending slavery was kind of secondary, but they wanted to end the war. So the process of this movie was about how Abraham Lincoln and, you know, his supporters and people on the right actually, you know, honestly made these deals, gave people, I don't know, cabinet, not necessarily cabinet positions, but, you know, appointed political offices if they would vote for the 13th Amendment or, you know, convince people to vote for it, convince people, you know, some people modern day equivalent of voting present, didn't vote, and to get the required amount of votes because they needed 20 votes from Democrats to get this passed. So that was really what this movie was about. And in the end, you see what happens is obviously the 13th Amendment passes, and you see this, you know, unity in a sense between these different factions in the Republican Party, as well as some people from the Democratic side. And, you know, whether or not that was ideological or if it was just, you know, motivated by, I mean, wanting a political position, it goes both ways. But, you know, the similarity I see between that and today is, you know, like I said, we're very polarized today, but, you know, again, not like we were then. And, I think it's an example of how different factions can work together. You know, and I use the word faction a lot because this is actually my my capstone project for my history paper for my history degree. But, you know, different groups, different ideological groups within the Republican Party, how they work together. You know, even though they didn't have necessarily the same ideology. They worked together for a larger goal. And even the more, you know, what they called him radical at the time, Congressman Stevens, Tommy Lee Jones, who was the staunch abolitionist, even he got up in Congress and said, I only believe in equality under the law and not equality of humans, you know, not racial equality, which he did. But he said that because he needed to, get that passed. And honestly, in a sense, he had to not necessarily compromise his principles. He didn't actually compromise his principles, but he gave the appearance that he had in order to ensure that they could, you know, maintain the coalition. You know, and I think that that's something important we need to see now, because you see these different factions within the Republican Party of today. You have the Tea Party, you have the Libertarians, you have the more establishment or the more, moderate, I guess, Republicans. And right now, a lot of what is happening is Tea Party members are saying, okay, we need to get rid of the rhinos. The more moderate Republicans are saying, okay, we tried that Tea Party thing, we're getting rid of them. The Libertarians are saying, you're all wrong, we need to reform this entire thing. And we're fighting back and forth. You know, no one wants to, quote-unquote, violate their principles. No one wants to, you know, kind of, I guess, pull in the other side. And we're very divided in the Republican Party. And this is something I've talked about before, but if you look at what happened in this movie, is that for that greater good, for that small step towards, you know, abolishing slavery and establishing equality eventually. I mean, it took, you know, another 100 years at least, but, people had to work together. And that's not something we're necessarily seeing today. I think there's so many people who are thinking, you know, I want change now. I want the other factions out so we can get things done, because, you know, it's their fault that we lost November. And you know what? I'm not going to take either side. I've talked about this before. I'm a conservative, but I consider myself a conservative who understands you need to work within the confines of a party. You know, you can't just, you know, completely overtake the entire party, kick out all the moderates and say, hey, we're completely conservative now. You know, I mean, I would like the Republican Party to return to its conservative roots. I'd like them to return to the party of Ronald Reagan. But you can't just do that in 6 months. You know, it starts from a grassroots level. It's a long process. And I think that the thing we see now is, you know, we want change now. And that's as if the people in 1865 had said, we want to end slavery now. Had they said that, had they said, we want to end slavery, we want to get voting rights, we want to, you know, give African Americans the same rights as whites, you know, which obviously now we know is, you know, the right thing to do, it never would have passed. Because at that time, that was extraordinarily radical. So they had to work together, even though the people who were strongly... the strong abolitionists, you know, at some points felt that they weren't going straight towards their goal. They still had to work with the more moderate people in their party. And I think that that's something, again, that we need to see today. We need to work together. I know that Lincoln at one point talked about, in the movie, talked about how you have a compass and, you know, if this compass always points due north. Yeah, you want to make it straight north, but you're not going to go straight north because you might run into swamps, you might run into mountains, you might run into valleys. Sometimes you have to go a little bit northwest or a little bit northeast to get to your final goal. And that's kind of the whole point of, I mean, from what I saw, the whole point of this movie is that in order to eradicate slavery, what they had to do was they had to work together, and they couldn't just barrel through and say, all right, we're going to get rid of slavery, we're going to get rid of, everybody's equal now. They couldn't do that because change happens slowly. And I think that's something we need to realize. Change happens slowly. You know, we're not going to, let's say 2014. I hate to do 2014 or 2016 speculation. I know I'm going to do it, and I know I do it, but I hate it. Still haven't gotten over the 2012 election. You know, but if we say, hey, we're gonna take back the House and Senate. I mean, we already have the House, but we're gonna take back the Senate in 2014. We're gonna barrel through all our ideas. We're gonna take the presidency in 2016. Everything is all gonna be great. That's not how it works. that's simply not how it works. You know, change is slow. And you have to, you know, take the small steps to get to your eventual goal. And that's what I learned during this movie. I talked about this a little bit, I think, last week in the case of abortion. I mean, if a bill was on the floor of the House tomorrow that we want to ban abortions in all cases, we want to defund Planned Parenthood, we want to, you know, I mean, you know, get rid of anything that's even remotely similar to abortion, you know, get rid of Plan B, get rid of, you know, all of that. The bill came up on the House, it would die immediately. I don't know if it'd have a single person vote for it, because that's too much too soon. Now, what we need to do as conservatives, as pro-life advocates, to get something like abortion eradicated, just like they did with slavery, is, you know, not just go all out right away. It's to start slowly. I mean, right now, I mean, we've had some successes with partial birth abortion. I think, you know, there's several different ways you can go. I think, you know, I mean, and that's why you see these laws about, you know, having, requiring sonograms or ultrasounds before an abortion occurs, or parental permission in some states for girls who are, I don't know, not 18. You know, another example, like defunding Planned Parenthood, whatever it is, it takes small steps. It takes small steps in policy to, you know, eventually kind of weed through that cultural change. You know, because for something like abortion, for something like slavery back in 1865, it requires an enormous cultural change. And if you look at the process of eradicating slavery, I mean, it was something that the founders talked about when they were putting the Constitution together. And it took a bloody civil war to finally get rid of it. I wish it hadn't. And you know, I mean, historically speaking, the Civil War wasn't just about slavery, you know, and that's an entirely different story. But, you know, it wasn't until 1865 when slavery was finally abolished. It wasn't until, you know, 100 years later, or, you know, 1964 with the Civil Rights Act. You know, it's, I mean, change takes time. I wish it could change in a day. I wish it could change in a year, but it can't. And so, I mean, if you haven't seen that movie yet, obviously I would recommend it. You know, it's a great movie. It's a little bit long, but it's a good movie. I won't give away the end. Obviously, we all know what happens at the end, but I won't spoil exactly how they, you know, work through the end of the film. But I would recommend going to see it. And think about that. Think about, you know, the situation in Congress in 1865 and how it compares to today. So that's what I did on my break. I went to see that movie. I really want to go see Skyfall. I know I've heard a lot of positive comments about that. My dad, my brother, two brothers went to see it yesterday. So I might go see that tonight after I spend several hours doing homework. But anyway, speaking of today, Saturday, November 24th is Small Business Saturday. And let me tell you, I didn't realize this until after I was halfway through eating my Subway sandwich at Target. I think I did something wrong. I went to Target and Subway on Small Business Saturday. And I stopped at a Quick Trip on the way home back to my apartment. So I obviously have not, you know, done my duty yet. I might go out a little bit later today and try to hit up some local businesses, which is a little bit tough when you're in the middle of the city or when you're a broke college student. But I would recommend if you're in a small town, even if you're not, hit up small businesses today, because, you know, those really are the backbone of our economy. You know, small business owners who did build their business, someone else didn't make that happen. They made that happen. I mean, I have aunts and uncles. My dad is a small business owner. You know, I know it's hard work. I know that, you know, good things like that start small. Very few big corporations, if any, started out as big corporations. You know, you start out as a small business and you grow from there. And that's, I mean, that's American entrepreneurship. That's how it works. You know, so show your support with your dollars. You know, go to a mom and pop grocery store or a local restaurant, or, you know, buy clothes from somewhere that, you know, only has one location, you know, And this is coming from a girl who also went to New York and Company this morning. So I'm a little bit of a hypocrite when it comes to that. I apologize. I do support private businesses, just not – or small businesses. It's tougher to do when I'm in college, when I'm a broke college student. But long story short, if you get the chance, just try to, you know, get pizza from a local pizzeria tonight. If anything, do that. You know, and walk in and shake the hand of the manager and thank them. Because, you know, that's where we're getting our jobs. And, you know, a year from now, a couple years from now, when these taxes from Obamacare really start to hit hard, we're not going to see as many of those small businesses. So thank them while you can. Give them your money while you can and support them. You know, because it's up to us to ensure that they'll have their businesses in the future. And especially today. I mean, I'm not saying you don't have to do it just today. Obviously, do it every day. But remember, it's Small Business Saturday. Make sure to check out a small business. So speaking of my break, I obviously this week was Thanksgiving week. I have been in Kansas all week. Yesterday was Black Friday. I am one of those people who gets up at midnight and doesn't go to sleep and waits in line for several hours to usually get nothing. I'll be honest, I'm not one of those people who goes for the televisions or for the iPods or, you know, I'm not one of those people who literally bite and push people out of the way to get what I want. I don't do that. I go more for the adrenaline rush, which I know sounds really, really weird, but there's something entertaining about, you know, getting up in the middle of the night and then shopping, you know. And hey, I find some good deals. I usually go get movies. Movies are like $1, $5, depending on what you're looking for. This year, unfortunately, I didn't get to go in the middle of the night, mostly because I wasn't feeling well. I was tired. It was Thanksgiving. I didn't have that much money, so I went the next day. I still went Black Friday shopping. It was fun. I mean, and then, of course, I saw Lincoln. But I did realize, you know, you're getting old when on Black Friday, instead of buying, like, DVDs and clothes and all of that stuff, you actually buy, like, household products. Yeah, so I stocked up on cosmetics and cleaning supplies. And I started making up my my Christmas list, which is all kitchen supplies and things that I need, not things that I want. So long story short, I'm 21 going on 35. That is what I learned on Black Friday this year. But hey, you know what? It was fun. I hope that you all got a chance to safely go Black Friday shopping yesterday. I will say, you know, it's crazy. I know most people are completely opposed to it. I completely understand it. I'm only 21. Who knows, 10 years from now, I might be completely tired of it. But just think about it. Do you really think Black Friday would be possible in the Soviet Union at its height? Of course not. You know, this is something that's, you know, I mean, indicative of a capitalistic society in good ways and in bad. You know, obviously, you have just the complete insanity that goes on in the middle of the night. And, of course, I've been in the middle of that. I haven't been the one being violent, of course. But, hey, you know, it's fun. So, if you want to be thankful for anything on Black Friday, be thankful that it's possible in the wonderful capitalistic country that we have here. So, in between the turkey and football and shopping and everything I did on, you know, during this break, I actually had some time to sit down and do what I consider to be fun and figure out how to reform our voting system or our election system, which is, you know, I'm cool like that. I actually sit down and try to figure out how to put the value back in our vote. And I have a couple different plans here. Now, this first plan is my ideal plan, what I would really like to see as far as voting and elections go. Unfortunately, it runs into some issues with the 24th and 14th Amendment, which you'll see once I lay it out. And then I have a secondary backup plan, which is more realistic and something that I think we could actually get accomplished. There are parts of the first one that we can get accomplished, but, you know, it makes it a little tough. So first thing on my Amy's revolutionary voting plan is, number one, reforming our tax system. Preferably, I'm a fan of the flat tax. I know that there's people who are like the fair tax instead. I just want to get rid of the progressive tax system altogether. But I like the flat tax. I think that everybody pays a certain percentage, therefore everybody's putting something in. And people who are millionaires and billionaires are, quote unquote, paying their fair share because they are paying more than people who are making $20,000 a year. You know, it's as simple as that. I don't know what exact percentage that is. I don't know how exactly it works out, but, you know, makes sense to me. So my first suggestion would be to institute a flat tax. Therefore, instead of having 50% of people not paying income taxes, we're having, you know, everybody pay something. Now, of course, there would be some exemptions, I think, for people in the military, for, you know, probably students, and then something for people who are very impoverished, some sort of subsidy or something. I'm not saying there shouldn't be a safety net. I just think that, you know, everybody needs to put something in. So that's step one. Step two is, now this is where it runs into some issues with the Constitution. You can't vote unless you pay your income taxes. Now, see, that makes sense to me. I mean, it's, from what I see, it's the equivalent of the property requirement for paying taxes. And I know that this sounds super radical right now and in 2012, but, you know, I mean, if you don't have something backing your vote, you're not going to take it as seriously. You know, if you're not paying taxes, and of course, you know, all government policies affect everyone, even if you're not paying income taxes. I understand that. But, I mean, I think you really need to feel in your wallet what the effect of, you know, government policies. And in this case, I mean, that's why I think it's important that, you know, the income tax would be the equivalent of the classic property tax. So you'll actually have time to kind of think about, you know, put your money where your mouth is. Quite literally, you'll have something backing your vote. You know, you might take a couple more seconds to think about it. Now, as I said, there would be exemptions for like the military, you know, who might not be paying income taxes. Obviously, they wouldn't, you know, they could still vote. Or students. And I'm going to get completely hammered for that. But sometimes I think that the voting age should be like 25, which would disenfranchise me because I'm only 21. But I'll be honest, I go to school with people my age, and it just doesn't, I mean, you have to have a full-time job. You have to be out in the real world to really understand the effect of government policies. And a lot of college students don't understand that. Now, I'm not suggesting that actually happens. This is kind of a pipe dream of mine that the voting age is a little bit higher. But anyway, you know, that's actually not part of my original plan. The next part of that plan, and this is the other issue that's going to run into some issues with the Constitution, I think there needs to be some sort of civics test for voting. Now, I know I'm going to get called a racist for that. I'm sure of that. And it's not intended to disenfranchise people who are in minorities, because to imply that it will means you actually think that people, that minorities, women, African-Americans, Hispanics, tend not to be able to pass those tests, which, you know, if I'm thinking of this correctly, that seems more racist to me. But anyway, it's obviously not, it's not intended to disenfranchise anyone. I just want people to, number one, put a value on their vote, you know, ensure that everybody has skin in the game, and number two, that people actually know what they're voting for. Now, I'm not saying you need to, you know, list all the amendments and memorize the Constitution, nothing complicated. I think you need to know who's running on the two major parties, who are the main office holders, you know, who's the president, who's the vice president, who's the Speaker of the House, you know, very basic things that you should be voting for, you know, and I think that they should change from precinct to precinct in year to year, so there's less of a chance to cheat. And, you know, I think that obviously, you know, you don't have to get 100% on it, because then nobody would be able to vote. So there's that, because I am so sick, and this doesn't exactly young conservative TV on my chat. I just popped up and said you have to take a test to get a driver's license. Why not take a test to determine the future of the entire nation? That's exactly it, and that's actually interesting you brought that up, because it's a point in my backup voting plan that I'll get to in a second here. But you know what? I am so sick of the uninformed voters. And this isn't something that just popped up after Barack Obama got reelected. I do think he has a massive amount of uninformed voters voting for him. But, you know, it's something that I've always thought, because, again, hey, I'm in college. I see so many people who can't even name who's running for president, and yet they're still voting. That shouldn't be happening. You know, and I'm not saying, you know, you should ban people from voting. I think everyone should have the opportunity to vote. But, you know, you need to have skin in the game. You need to know what you're talking about. Because if you're not, that's a wasted vote. And I think this all gets back to the fact that we need to value our vote more. Because there are so many people who don't care. There are things like voter fraud, of course, which makes people think, hey, my vote's not going to count anyway. Which, you know, another key point in my plan is obviously voter ID. Obviously you need to be able to prove who you are before you vote. So there's that. Where was I going with that? But you need to put value on your vote, because so many people think, hey, I voted, it doesn't really matter. That shouldn't happen, because voting in this country is something that not everyone has. It is not only a right, it's a privilege. And with great power comes great responsibility. You know, you need to take the responsibility to know what you're talking about and to make sure you have skin in the game. Make sure you are paying into the system that you're voting for. You know, so that is my ideal. In an ideal world, that is what I'd like to see. However, here's my backup plan. In that it, I from what I can tell, it's actually not, it doesn't run into any constitutional issues. So first off, and this is why I said I get to this a little later, instead of having a civics test before you vote, why don't we have some sort of class that can be part of, you know, make it a requirement in high school, or make it a requirement, well, I guess you couldn't make it a requirement to register to vote, because that would technically be a test. But put it within our education system and make it kind of like driver's ed. You have to go through, even if it's just 2 hours, some sort of crash course about who's running, about who leads our country, about how our Constitution works, about who your governor is, who your representatives are, just so you have basic knowledge about what's happening. And that's something that you can institute within the educational system. Now, I understand that our educational system is obviously not not in good shape, so that also requires massive, massive change. And, I mean, that's an entirely different subject. I think that the Department of Education needs to be more of a state issue as opposed to a federal issue, and instead of requiring so much on standardization, require more on teaching kids how to learn, not what to learn. But again, that's a little bit, you know, way out there. So, you know, instituting some sort of class like like driver's ed, you know, and make it a requirement during high school, so at least people kind of know what they're doing before they cast their vote. And then I think another thing that we need to really focus on is, this is going to require a cultural change, and some of this takes place within the educational system. You know, and this is one of those $64 million questions that there's no clear answer, but we need to reform our, you know, our morals and our values, and to make sure our priorities are in the right place. Because I think it's ridiculous that more people take American Idol voting seriously than they take voting for the President of the United States. That shouldn't be happening. You know, and like I said, we need to put the value back into our voting. You know, and some of that is reforming the policies so that, you know, we can take it more seriously. And you know, go back to the educational system. Make sure children are taught, you know, critical thinking, taught to think on their own, taught to really value their vote. And again, I mean, that's you're going to get into some issues with the educational system, because our public educational system is massively, massively screwed up. But, however, you know, I think that's really the place to start. Just like everything else, you know, almost every debate you get into can get back to the educational system. I'll be completely honest. I should do an entire show just on my issues or my suggestions on how to reform the educational system. Partially before, you know, I won't go off on a huge tangent there, but school choice is a big one. You know, if parents should have a choice to send, you know, your choice of school should not be determined by your zip code. You know, have a voucher system, or, you know, that's a whole big other debate. So reforming our education system, I do think is key in a sense to reforming our voting system. You know, it all kind of ties in together. You know, so, I mean, that one, I haven't seen any constitutional violations yet with that one. Again, most of it really is within the educational system. There is one thing I would like to tweak. I think that right after the November 6th election, people tended to say, hey, we need to get rid of the Electoral College. You know, make sure that one vote counts for one person. Let's turn this into a direct democracy. And no, just long story short, no. I'm not even going to go close to mob rule. However, I do think it's important that the Electoral College is tweaked a little bit. I think that the best solution I've seen is a lot of states actually do like district methods, where, you know, instead of all of the electoral votes from one state going to one candidate, they actually split it. So, I mean, for example, Illinois does not do a district voting system that I know of. At least I don't believe so. So therefore, Chicago basically votes for the state of Illinois. I mean, that shouldn't be happening when these big cities are pretty much determining the outcome of the election. Because if you look, I mean, if you've seen the entire map of how the election went between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, you see that there are a lot of red counties in states like Illinois, but right around the big cities, it's all blue. And that means the entire state goes to the Democrats. So, I mean, that's my suggestion about the Electoral College. I think that's going to require some sort of constitutional amendment. Perhaps. I don't know. Well, perhaps not. I think it's more on a state issue. But tweak it a little bit, do a little bit more of a district method as opposed to, you know, straight each one vote. You know, I mean, all the electoral votes from one day go to one candidate. I have a couple more things I need. I want to talk about Christmas even more. But I think the last couple weeks, I'll do this first. The last couple weeks, I've been talking a lot about Rules for Radicals and Saul Alinsky. And I've been trying to talk about at least one or two tactics a week, something that I've noticed in the news, and perhaps, you know, a way to either acknowledge it or to fight back on it. So I actually want to focus on a couple different ones this week, and this actually kind of leads into my discussion on the greatest holiday of the year, Christmas, which is a month from tomorrow. So the two major rules that I'm going to focus on today are number one, ridicule is a man's most powerful weapon, and then the second one, the threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. Now, I've noticed, even though, you know, technically yesterday was the first day of the Christmas season, I personally have been one of those people who have been kind of celebrating it a few weeks early, which I know I shouldn't be doing. I need to pay attention to Thanksgiving, but Christmas is my favorite holiday, so I have to celebrate it a little bit early. So on Twitter and on Facebook, you know, on social media sites, I and you know, some of my friends are starting to get a lot of flack from, to be honest, this is going to sound like an oxymoron, but evangelical atheists who are basically saying, oh my gosh, I can't believe you believe in the imaginary man in the sky, and you know, you're anti-science, and you're just complete ridicule. not, you know, not actual facts, just ridiculing Christians for believing in God, or Jews for believing in God, or Muslims, or you know, I mean, not, you know, anyone for believing in God and believing in a higher power. So that was the first thing that struck me, and that ridicule is a man's most powerful weapon. But, you know, the backside to that is the threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. Now, I'm not actually terrified of people who say things like that, but, you know, when it happens a lot, it's annoying, it can start to, you know, pile up a little bit. But when you really think about it, what does it mean? You know, so what, they don't believe in God. Good for them. You know, I mean, there's a difference between being, you know, an evangelical Christian and, you know, someone who doesn't believe in God, who basically wants to eliminate the views of all Christians and mock and ridicule the views of Christians. And obviously not all atheists, not all agnostics are like this, but there are some that I've run into who use these Solinsky tactics to ridicule God-fearing people. But as I said, remember that the threat is usually more terrifying than the thing itself. These people obviously have nothing better to do with their life than, you know, ridicule someone else on the internet. So keep that in mind. And this actually, thankfully, ties into my War on Christmas idea, this is something that really frustrates me, to be completely honest. And I'm just not saying War on Christmas. I'm saying war on Hanukkah, war on, you know, Ramadan, Kwanzaa, you know, whatever holiday it is, because we've become so secular that we're basically not celebrating anything anymore. And, you know, who knows, I might get in trouble for this, but, you know, like my school, I go to a Catholic school, but we don't wish each other Merry Christmas here, you know, because apparently that's offensive or something. You know, if I walk into the student center and see a menorah hanging up or something, I'm not going to be offended. I think that's kind of cool to see things from other religions, you know, to see other people expressing their faith. I don't see that as being a problem. But apparently in this secularized society, it's apparently a problem to talk about your faith. However, it's completely okay to, you know, bathe the entire campus, an entire town, an entire, you know, whatever, with secularism, with you know, and just take the Christ out of Christmas. And leave all of this flashy, secularized, commercialized, Hallmark cardized Christmas left. And that's all there is. It's really taking the meat out of it. You know, and even though yesterday was technically the first day of the Christmas season, we've seen this for a couple of weeks now. The quote-unquote war on Christmas has, I mean, it's been full swing for quite a while now. We've seen a few cities, I can't remember exactly where, I think it's somewhere in California, which really doesn't surprise me, somewhere in California, that is actually banning nativity scenes because they're religiously affiliated. I think it's in Chicago, which surprises me that Chicago hasn't done this anyway. They actually, instead of having a Christmas tree, they're having a holiday tree. Again, taking the Christ out of Christmas, taking the religion out of a, you know, what is a time for, Santa Monica, thank you for that. It just popped up on the chat. Yes, taking the religion out of a time that's supposed to be a religious celebration. Now, if you're an atheist and you're agnostic and you want to celebrate Christmas, good for you. I mean, it's a time of giving. It's a time of, I mean, whatever, you know, family or whatever you see it as. I don't have a problem with that. You know, just like I don't have a problem with other religions celebrating their holiday. The thing I find most interesting with this, and it kind of ties back into my Alinsky tactics from this week, is that what I don't understand, what must you think of your own beliefs or lack thereof if you have to literally eliminate those of another? I mean there's a big difference. I mean, there are radical leftist atheists out there who want nothing to do with God, who want no mention of him, who want no mention of any sort of religious celebration. It can't be seen because somehow children might be corrupted. You know, so they have to eradicate it. You know, how insecure in your own beliefs do you have to be if you have to actually eradicate the views of another? Hey, that's what I keep seeing. Because the only explanation I can think of is that you're insecure in your own beliefs. Now, if I'm walking down the street and I see the a symbol for another religion's holiday, I'm not going to get offended. It's not going to change my views. I still believe in God. I'm still a Christian. I'm still going to celebrate Christmas. I have a friend who comes from a Jewish family. I wish her happy Hanukkah. It doesn't affect my views. Because I'm secure in my own religion. I'm secure in my own Christianity. However, there are people out there waging this secular battle against Christmas who are apparently not secure enough in their own beliefs that they have to actually eliminate the views of another. You know, and I mean, take religion out of it. If you're just arguing with, you know, between liberals and conservatives, I don't want to get rid of liberal ideas. I think it's good to argue back and forth. I would like to reform their ideas. I think that they're misguided, but I'm not going to eliminate them. Because can you imagine how boring that would be? To be completely honest, how boring that would be to eliminate all of your opposition? You know, it's getting rid of all the excitement in life, you know? I mean, when I'm arguing with somebody, I don't want to get rid of their ideas. So I'm still not understanding why you would want to completely eradicate someone else's beliefs. Because you know what? In a sense, I'm libertarian on this, or I'm an American on this, in that this is a country with freedom of religion. You know, or you could choose not to be part of religion. I don't care. You know, I think seeing religious diversity is a great thing. I have a friend who is a Buddhist. I think that's awesome. You know, because I don't want to be completely isolated with my own beliefs, but I don't want to completely get rid of everybody else's ideas either. So I don't understand it. I mean, I honestly don't understand why they care. You know, how is, you know, I mean, putting up a Christmas tree with an angel on top, how is that going to offend a child who is, let's say, Jewish or Muslim or an atheist? So it's a symbol of another religion. So what? I mean, it's really discounting the American people because you're assuming that, you know, people are going to be automatically converted or affected if they see something from an alternative idea, and yet, unless liberals are the ones saying, "Oh, you only watch Fox News. Oh, you only listen to Rush Limbaugh. You don't look for any other ideas other than your own." Yet, a lot of the same ones are the ones trying to completely de-Christianize Christmas and try to eradicate anything that's against their ideas or anything that might slightly offend anyone. It's ridiculous. You know, I guess a lot of it comes back to political correctness, which I think a couple weeks ago I declared a war on political correctness. I declare wars a lot, apparently. I am a very competitive person. We're so worried about being politically correct that we're losing our backbone. You know, now I'll be honest. Like, when I gave my voting plan on Twitter when I wrote about it, of course I was called a racist. Of course people said I hate minorities. I actually got told this past week that I am not an actual woman because I'm a conservative. So I'm not – this liberal woman actually told me, "You're not one of us," quote unquote, because of my ideas. Yeah, and again, ridicule is their most powerful weapon. But not if you don't react to it. You know what? They can say what they want. I don't care. I'm not going to be politically correct. You know, I mean, I think there's times when you have to have some sort of decorum in an argument. I'm not just going to shout profanities. I'm not going to use racial slurs because those are offensive. But, I mean, I really think political correctness is just gutting our debates. Because, you know, when you're only using politically correct phrases, you're losing the core ideas of what you're arguing about. You know, I mean, if you're arguing about climate change, for example, I'm a climate change skeptic, I'll be honest. But if you're arguing about climate change, then, you know, the way that that word is phrased, it means you can kind of morph it to anything you believe. So, because it's not global warming anymore. You know, so if the weather starts changing, climate change still applies, but global warming doesn't. I mean, it's changing the language to change the argument without admitting you were wrong. That's why politically correct phrases change over the years. You know, so, I mean, and Christmas time is the last time that I want political correctness. So I'm not going to be politically correct. I'm going to wish my friends a Merry Christmas. I'm going to wish my Jewish friends a Happy Hanukkah. Because, you know, I believe in God. I'm secure in my beliefs. And I don't care what other people think. I want people to know that I'm a Christian. I want people to know that I believe in God. I'm not going to hide it. And I'm not going to hide it behind a guise of political correctness. You know, I mean, and actually, I will say, okay, here's something awesome I saw. I listened to, actually, on the way home, on my drive home, I listened to several Christmas stations because I think they're like every other radio station on the radio. Some of them are holiday stations. Some of them are Christmas stations. And 94.1 in, I think it was Kansas City. It was towards the western part of the state. They said, you know, Kansas City's Christmas music station. And then at the end it said something like, because we don't like political correctness, or because that might offend somebody. I mean, they were proudly proclaiming Merry Christmas. This is Kansas City's Christmas station. Good for them. So if you're in Kansas City, I highly suggest you listen to 94.1. I'll be honest, I think it might be a country station. I'm not sure exactly what they do during the regular season. But if you're in that area, I would highly suggest to listen to that Christmas station, because they're proudly a Christmas station, not necessarily a holiday station. So, which reminds me, I need to start putting up my Christmas lights and getting my apartment all Christmatized? I don't even know if that's the word. I winterized my apartment at work with snowflakes. Now I need to decorate my apartment with Christmas supplies and garlands and snowflakes, all that fun stuff. So, one of the last things I want to talk about, and I know, again, I know I said I'm a hypocrite when it comes to this. I know I said I wasn't going to talk about this, but I want to talk a little bit about 2016 speculation, just because it's kind of become a hot topic in the last at least couple days, because apparently Jeb Bush is considering a run for president. Now, I'll be honest. I don't know a lot about Jeb Bush. I mean, I think he's really good on education from what I know about him. But he will never, ever, 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 ever get over the Bush name. At least not in my lifetime. That's an automatic Democrat win, to put a Bush up against a possible Clinton. Can you imagine if Hillary Clinton won, we would have a Clinton-Bush race? You know, so no offense to Jeb Bush, but no. Please don't. You know, take a cabinet position. I'm cool with that. Just, I mean, we will be shooting ourselves in the foot if he is the nominee. Now, I know Rubio is obviously, he went to Iowa, I don't know, what was it last week, really throwing his hat in the ring. I'm a fan of Marco Rubio. I think he's definitely the front runner now. I know Bobby Jindal has talked a little bit. There's been some speculation that he might run. I like Bobby Jindal as well. You know, people are tossing around Scott Walker's name. I don't know if he actually has said anything about it, but, you know, hey, I like Scott Walker as well. Paul Ryan, obviously, has a very special place in my heart. But, you know, I was actually holding out for him in 2012. I'm wondering if he actually might just be better where he is now. I think he would be a good maybe Speaker of the House in 4 years or whenever. I think he's great as a budget chair because he's a policy wonk. You know, he would be good as, you know, I don't know, as Secretary of Business, which apparently we're going to have now. But, you know, like a cabinet position, I think he would be very good at. So, but, you know, obviously he has a special place in my heart. But you know, the thing we have to look at is that the conservatives have a very, very good bench. We have several good candidates for 2016. You know, I mean, I know I'm getting ahead of myself. I know I said I wouldn't do it, but I can't resist. I mean, mostly because I just had to throw out there that Jeb Bush really, 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 really should not run, because that's really, really shooting ourselves in the foot. You know, what we really need to look at is 2014, and trying to take back the Senate. You know, I what I would love is to see a 2014 debate kind of turn out, you know, in a similar fashion as 1994. I know we took the House then, that's, you know, slightly different. But if we could really get a new contract for America and really get a Republican Congress, House, and Senate with a backbone, I mean, you know, I don't, the odds of Barack Obama actually working with a Republican Congress is very, very low. But I would love to see Harry Reid out of the majority leader spot, mostly because of that. You know, I think that's really something we need to focus on, and that's something we need to start working on now. So while I know I took a couple minutes to talk about 2016 speculation, what we really need to be debating right now is how to change our messaging, how to work together. This really ties in back, you know, what I started with, in that the factions within the Republican Party, the Tea Party, the more moderates, the bring in the libertarians, we need to work together. We need to develop a platform that we can all agree on and that we can all fight for. Because honestly, and I hate to say this, but that's what the Democrats do. I don't want to mimic the Democrats in any way, but look at it. I mean, Barack Obama is a very, very liberal president. However, many moderate Democrats voted for him. You don't see the factions within their party that we have on our side. Now, I think that that's indicative of the fact that, you know, we're more inclined to debate, we're more inclined to, you know, have these ideological differences. We're not going to just fall in line and vote for the next candidate. But, you know, once 2016, 2014 comes around, we can't have these debates going on. We need to be united behind a candidate, whether you like them or not. You know, unless somehow we elect a fascist to run or something, you know, someone who, you know, you're morally, you know, can't vote for, which is never going to happen, at least not, you know, within my lifetime. You need to unite. Because I'm not saying that's necessarily why Mitt Romney lost, but he was not the uniting candidate. He was not what Barack Obama was to the Democrats. You know, and I hate to say that. I mean, and I think as a president, Barack Obama is a great divider. In no way is he a great uniter. However, you know, we need to ensure that we've changed our messaging, that we can all, you know, that this petty infighting is not around when we get to 2014, because we're going to have to do a lot of work. You know, and I think we're all still licking our wounds. We're all still, you know, getting over our loss and trying to figure out where to go from here. But, you know, and hey, you know what? It's fun to talk about 2016. But, and I'll indulge in it every once in a while. But we need to work on our messaging. We need to work on working together. And we need to work on moving this party forward in a unified way. Because if we don't, we're going to be incredibly disjointed, incredibly divided, you know, just by 2014. Now, I know a lot of liberals are saying the Republican Party is dead. The Republican Party is not dead. But it will be if we can't unite. So I encourage that. You know, I mean, we need to unite, and we need to ensure that we have a lot of young leaders moving forward to take the spot. So with that, I'm gonna go ahead and wrap you up. If you would like to continue the conversation, my Twitter handle is AmyLutz4, AmyLutz4. My website is youngfederalist.com. I should have this up. It is available by download on iTunes, actually. I'll post it on Twitter and on my website. And I should have it up on YouTube eventually when I get to it. So Thanks for listening, and I will see you next week, same place, same time.